Welcome to part one of Inside the Issue, the future role of cell mods in the management of multiple myeloma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Paul Richardson from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and to begin, he provided an overview of this important topic.
I think cell mods have become really probably the most important oral agents that we've developed in the last several years by far because of their extraordinary activity and their ability to overcome resistance to other classes of drugs, including immunomodulators. And this is an important point because these are not IMiDs. They are distinct. Essentially, they modulate the cereblon E3 ligase complex. And above all, the key thing to understand is that they close the complex to a much greater degree than the immunomodulators do. And by so doing, the targeted degradation of Ikaros and Aiolos is that much more robust. And that in turn not only is like targeting the sort of center of the Death Star, if you will, in the myeloma, it's also bringing in, you know, Federation forces, if you will, in the immune system to really do away with the Death Star, i.e. the malignant myeloma cell. And this sort of complexity of interaction is so fascinating because it's led us to christen drugs like mezigdomide, for example, CAR T in a pill, because not only is it a powerful destroyer of the myeloma cell directly through this closure of the cereblon E3 ligase complex, but it's also a remarkable immune enhancer. It marshals the immune system from both the T-cell subsets and also, fascinatingly, NK cells as well. So there's a broad array of action. So how do they work? Well, iberdomide and mezigdomide to different degrees close the complex. They're large molecules, they're degraders, but they're large in size, so they tightly fit into this pocket. And I like that about them because it means in terms of off-target effects, we really don't see much other than myelosuppression. So to give you some sort of construct around comparison, powerful IMiDs like lenalidomide and pomalidomide close the cereblon E3 ligase complex to about 15 to 20% tops. Iberdomide is able to close it to a remarkable 50%, and strikingly, mezigdomide, with its unique structure, closes it down by 100%. Also, the other thing about mezigdomide to understand is that it's developed deliberately to actually penetrate tissue, solid tissue, if you will, in your malignancy. And by so doing, it's particularly tailored for targeting extramedullary disease. And that's a trick of its medicinal chemistry. So in aggregate, they are distinct. They target the cereblon E3 ligase complex. They truly modulate it. They degrade. And downstream, they trigger highly efficient degradation of both Ikaros and Aiolos and overcome resistance to prior exposure to immunomodulators. And what's so interesting, we have a lovely case in my practice of a patient who literally came off isatuximab, pomalidomide, and dexamethasone, very potent triplet. He actually benefited for a number of years. And when he came on to the mezigdomide study that he participated in, we had his marrow and his myeloma. And his myeloma was enriched for Aiolos all across its cell surface. And when we had him a week into mezigdomide, almost all of the Aiolos had disappeared. And it was a classic sort of correlative example of what we saw. And this particular patient went on to a complete response. So we see this overdrive, if you will, of immunomodulator resistance. And what's very important is we also see overdrive of resistance to other classes of drugs, including proteasome inhibitors and CD38 targeting monoclonal antibodies. I think what's very important to share with you, though, Neil, is that what struck us in the pivotal trials around mezigdomide a few years ago, which we published in the New England Journal, was that we saw in BCMA-exposed patients activity from mezigdomide, actually 50% response rate, which was, we thought, encouraging for just, you know, essentially monotherapy, the combination of mezigdomide and steroid. And with iberdomide, interestingly, we saw a similar, although less pronounced, degree of response in BCMA-exposed patients. So very encouraging in that regard. But very importantly, with mezigdomide, we saw striking activity in extramedullary disease. And in the trial overall, of which there were over 160 patients, we saw about a 30% response rate in those patients with clearly highly resistant extramedullary involvement. So promising signals in those regards. And I think for clinicians on listening to us, you may remember that the IMiDs are active in myeloma, exquisitely so, but I think it's fair to say they've not been our best class of drugs against extramedullary disease. And it's very affirming to see that mezigdomide achieves that, for example. And also, I think, in a sense, that helps us understand why one can think of this as a distinctly different class of drug in terms of its utility.
So let's focus on the existing clinical trial data for these agents.
I think the important point to share with the audience is that both iberdomide and mezigdomide have shown striking activity in their own rights. First, with iberdomide being tested in combination with dexamethasone, and then mezigdomide with dexamethasone. And what these platforms established was the efficacy of both approaches. Essentially, what we saw with iberdomide combined with dexamethasone was an overall response rate of around 28% or so in heavily pretreated refractory patients. And I think what's important to share with the audience is with mezigdomide plus dexamethasone, the response rate was higher, reflecting the greater potency of mezigdomide. But nonetheless, both combinations were exquisitely active and at the same time were well tolerated. So with the mezigdomide dexamethasone study in a large, heavily pretreated relapse refractory population, 160 strong plus, we were able to demonstrate a response rate of comfortably above 40%, with subsets enjoying particular responses, 50% in those patients who were otherwise refractory to BCMA-based approaches, including antibody-drug conjugates, bispecifics, and even CAR-T. And at the same time, as I mentioned previously, we saw striking activity in extramedullary disease. With iberdomide, we saw a similar profile. There was some activity in extramedullary disease, but perhaps less so than mezigdomide, recognizing they are designed slightly differently in terms of their molecular structure and for tissue penetration. But importantly, there was activity also in BCMA refractory patients, as well as triple class refractory patients. So both drugs performed very well. What's become really exciting, Neil, is when you combine these drugs with other backbone agents, be it bortezomib, be it carfilzomib, be it daratumumab, and even elotuzumab. And I think that's what's really captured our attention. And then finally, real-world studies showing, for example, the combination of iberdomide with cyclophosphamide and dexamethasone, a good workhorse regimen in community practice in certain settings. All of these are consistently shown really remarkable results. And then I think what to me is particularly eye-catching is the use of these drugs with bispecifics. And for example, there's very interesting data from this last year's ASH meeting combining mezigdomide with elranatamab, obviously, which targets BCMA. And that combination is strikingly active, as well as being remarkably well tolerated. So there's real promise for these drugs as companions to both standards of therapy that are well established, such as PIs, CD38 antibodies, SLAMF7 antibodies, and so on, as well as the next generation of immunotherapies, specifically bispecifics. And to that extent, also, there is a number of studies ongoing combining the CELMoDs with, in fact, antibody-drug conjugates, specifically belantamab mafodotin. So I think the promise of these as companion drugs with everything is really exciting. And it reflects the tolerability that you and I, Neil, have talked about before, which is that there's basically a very predictable pattern of side effects, which I know we'll come to in a minute. But also there are very few off-target effects, which I think is very important. Because what we're learning with myeloma, we've got tons of exciting, efficacious, active options. Safety, though, and tolerability and application to real-world practice has become very important. And I think what we see with mezigdomide and with iberdomide is this capacity for true real-world translation. You can move these drugs into the community, into outpatient practice. Nothing unexpected typically happens. You see relatively predictable side effect profiles. And I think some of this is very important to share with the audience, not least of which when we combined mezigdomide and dexamethasone in highly refractory patients enrolled during the pandemic. In this large 160-plus patients experience, this week we published in the New England Journal a few years ago now, we did not have a single COVID death, even though we did see COVID infection. And that's in striking comparison or contrast to the bispecific approaches, which obviously have been remarkably effective, such as teclistamab. But certainly during the pandemic, we saw impressive mortality from COVID during the same time period of enrollment. And I think that tells you a little bit about the differences in the infectious profiles for these two classes of approaches. So let's talk a little bit more, Neil, about specific activity. What we saw with bortezomib combined with mezigdomide was striking activity. We saw striking activity with carfilzomib as well. And an important point to share with your audience is for example, the combination of mezigdomide and bortezomib, we saw response rates as high as 80% and above, even in patients who had prior bortezomib. So this points to the striking synergy. Similar synergy has been reported with iberdomide, combined either with carfilzomib, and indeed also more recently in an abstract presented at ASH, very nice data with iberdomide, carfilzomib, Dara, and Dex, which was a quadruplet approach presented by Ola Langren. Really a remarkable set of results seen with that. And I think that's particularly exciting. That's the so-called Rekindle study. So moving to Mezi in a little bit more detail, I think what we've also shown is that You can combine it very effectively with daratumumab and even with elotuzumab. But what's really, I think, important to share with everyone is right now there are two pivotal trials, Successor 1 and Successor 2, that are ongoing. Successor 1 is comparing mezigdomide with a combination of bortezomib and dexamethasone to the standard of care of pomalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone. And Successor 2 is comparing the combination of mezigdomide, carfilzomib, and dexamethasone to carfilzomib and dexamethasone. And this, I think, is really important because these will hopefully provide the platform for FDA approval of mezigdomide in relapsed refractory myeloma. Similarly, the Excalibur study is ongoing and has actually had some preliminary results reported onto it, and I think we'll come to that in a minute. But essentially, we've seen there also phase three evidence of benefit. So very exciting times for both these drugs.
I want to just bring up another topic that kind of occurred to me as you've been talking here now, which is the issue of extramedullary disease. And I'm curious if you just take a breath and comment a little bit on, you, first of all, clinically, when you see this, where you see it in the body, that you see extramedullary disease, what kind of clinical scenarios, how people present, but also your vision of pathophysiology in terms of why is it that, you know, for example, these CELMoDs seem to work better in extramedullary disease. Any comments in general on the whole issue of your vision of extramedullary disease?
That's a super question, Neil. I think the point to understand about EMD is that myeloma is a reticuloendothelial disease, which has this particular avidity for the bone, and not just the bone marrow, but the cortical bone as well. So it's part of the natural history of this disease that it has this extramedullary affinity. It's important to remember that because if you look back to autopsy series, it's back as long as the 60s of, you know, last century, 1965 or so. There's a very interesting paper published, which was an autopsy series, sadly, on a whole series of myeloma patients from the Midwest. And the incidence of hepatosplenomegaly from plasma cell involvement was a striking 40%. So I think it's important to remember that this disease has this reticuloendothelial component, and extramedullary behavior is part of its natural history. I think in terms of the presentation, newly diagnosed patients with EMD tend to have highly sensitive extramedullary disease, which responds to therapy. It's an entirely different story later. When you have relapsed refractory disease where patients have been through two, three, four lines of therapy, EMD at this time is a very different animal and it's extremely difficult to treat. I find EMD most challenging after immunotherapy has failed a patient. Where we see EMD being the most dangerous, in my view, is, you know, after immunotherapies of various stripes have unfortunately failed the patient, and you have, for example, soft tissue extramedullary disease in liver, abdominal viscera, pleura, and soft tissue even in nodal distributions can be very challenging. And then, unfortunately, what we are seeing, which is an area of exquisite unmet medical need, is central nervous system disease, Neil. We're definitely seeing more central nervous system relapse with leptomeningeal disease and even increased numbers of patients with actual plasmacytoma in their cortex. So these are patterns of relapse. Now, fortunately, the CNS myeloma remains relatively rare, but it's incredibly hard to treat. So I think big challenge with EMD. Now, you ask the next question, which is, you know, how does CELMoDs take them on? Well, in fairness to iberdomide, it's a little different to mezigdomide in terms of its structure. It most certainly is, actually. There are some important differences. Mezigdomide, however, is designed for excellent tissue penetration. And I think once you get your small molecule into where it needs to go and it can work its magic through Ikaros ALRs degradation and shutting down what I call that core of the Death Star, the cerebral E3 ligase complex, myeloma, even if it's EMD, struggles to survive. So I think this has been the most effective agent as an oral agent that I've certainly had the privilege to use in EMD, recognizing there are others, of course. You know, for example, selinexor is active in EMD. In the past, combining IMiDs with PIs and cytotoxic chemotherapy has been a mainstay of taking on EMD. I just think the cerebral E3 ligase modulators with their degrading function and their molecular structure constitute a new step up. And I'm hopeful that more broadly in the degrader space, we'll see this prove to be true as well. And we'll just have to see from clinical results. But EMD is a challenge, Neil. And I think it's a marker of poor prognosis, and particularly in advanced patients with relapsed refractory disease.
Could you comment a little bit more about CNS involvement with myeloma, what you see clinically, and have actual objective responses been observed with CELMoDs?
Neil, it's again, great question. CNS myeloma, and is there a role for CELMoDs? Well, we do know that pomalidomide crosses the blood-brain barrier and can be useful in CNS disease combined with other agents. And that's established in lymphoma as well as in myeloma. So there is a role there. In terms of CELMoDs, I think the data are very early, so I can't really comment with authority about CNS involvement. I can, however, share that, you know, we mainstays of therapy constitute, you know, craniospinal radiation, intrathecal therapy, which in my experience has always been unfortunately a bit hit and miss and not easy for patients. You typically have to place an Ommaya. You can't really rely on repeated lumbar puncture because you've got that disease in the thoracolumbar spine, typically, you know. So you can see all the practical issues. So drugs that cross the blood-brain barrier, we desperately need. And I think POM does. Whether the CELMoDs do to a meaningful degree, I think studies will hopefully elucidate. But basically, one very important agent that we unfortunately had to sort of mothball, but I wish we could pull it back, was a remarkable proteasome inhibitor called mirizumab, which crosses the blood-brain barrier. And in myeloma patients, we saw striking responses. So my kind of, you know, dream would be that we get a PI that works in the central nervous system, mirizumab might be an example, and combine it with the CELMoDs, for example, you know, either mezigdomide, which probably would be the most likely to be active, versus iberdomide. So more to follow, hopefully, in that space. One drug that does cross the blood-brain barrier that's already bioavailable, Anil, which is important to share with the audience, is selinexor. That does get into the central nervous system. So please remember that, because when you, I mean, really, CNS disease can be such a challenge. One other sort of pearl to share with the audience, Neil, is that prognosis with CNS disease is critically governed by systemic control. If you have disease that's systemically out of control, your likelihood of making any difference with treating the CNS is much lower. If you have excellent systemic control, then it's really worth being as creative and as thoughtful as you can be with CNS-directed therapy.
So the efficacy findings you just reviewed are really exciting. What about adverse events?
Obviously, immunomodulatory drugs, we've become very comfortable with their use, recognizing they're very active and relatively safe in the younger patient. Be a little bit more careful in the older patient, especially for any potential vascular effects, as well as other such things as myelosuppression. And obviously with lenalidomide, we can see significant GI toxicities. I think what's so exciting about iberdomide in particular is it's remarkably well tolerated. As Saga likes to say, you know, in our toxicity tables for iber, when we present them, there are a lot of zeros in the grade 3 and grade 4 columns, and particularly, of course, thankfully, lots of zeros in the grade 5 column. I think the important point is that iberdomide is remarkably well tolerated and makes it a very attractive option in the upfront and early relapse setting, in my opinion, and above all, also in maintenance, actually. Mezigdomide is equally, I think, generally well tolerated, but we have to be careful with it because it does cause neutropenia, and you have to be very proactive about that in the form of using growth factors. I think what I like about mezigdomide, though, is off-target, there's very little. We have not seen significant GI effects. Very encouragingly, Neil, we've not seen neuropathy. And we also have not seen thromboembolism with standard thromboembolic anticoagulation strategies, as simple as full-dose aspirin. So we're pleased with this. And I think the same story is true of iberdomide, even more so because it's well-tolerated and remarkably free of non-hematologic toxicities. One very important piece to share with the audience, and I think this sets both drugs apart from the immunomodulators and in particular from lenalidomide, is that there doesn't appear to be anything like the same second cancer risk. This is mediated through a CK1 alpha mechanism that's off target that lenalidomide unfortunately modulates to select potentially P53 mutated cells, in particular in the setting of the marrow milieu and stem cells in particular, which sets you up for the risk of secondary leukemia and MDS. As I think everyone is very familiar, markedly magnified by exposure to melphalan. If you don't have melphalan, however, there is still a risk. And the point is that both iberdomide and mezigdomide do not do this. So I think there's the real promise from these drugs, and in particular for iber, as we think about it as a maintenance agent, for example, there's the particular promise of iberdomide being free of this particularly challenging late complication, and for mezigdomide the same. So really important to share that with the audience, because I think as we think about these new agents, what do? They overcome resistance to immunomodulators, which is key. They overcome resistance to other drugs, PIs, CD38 antibodies, BCMA-exposed patients who become refractory either to bispecifics, antibody-drug conjugates, and even CAR-T. But very excitingly, the late side effects, such as second cancer risk, may be markedly less. Now, we have to prove that. but preclinically, a number of laboratories, including my colleague Adam Sperling, who's done fabulous work in this space, have demonstrated that this is likely. So with all of that in mind, I think there's a really bright future for these oral agents as a very important new addition to the therapeutic armamentarium.
If you were going to start a patient on Iber, would you discuss any side effects for them to anticipate? I mean, do you see any side effects? I'm not clear that they actually have side effects.
Well, unfortunately, every effective drug we have does, of course, Neil, but the side effects are very manageable. What we do see is you can see fatigue. You can see, obviously, most importantly, suppression of counts. Iber less so than Mezi, but I do think Iber is myelosuppressive. You have to be aware of that. Fatigue is definitely a side effect, but it's gratifyingly free of neuropathy, thromboembolic risk. You know, off-target effects we just don't see. Mezi definitely can cause fatigue. It's very powerful. It can have a profound effect on neutrophils, but you can reverse those. And what we found so interesting is even though you can have low ANCs, the incidence of febrile neutropenia is rewardingly low, or reassuringly low, I would say. And also the incidence of serious complex infections is remarkably low. So, you know, sort of, I would say bread and butter for hematologists. We know how to handle neutropenia. Just be proactive with it. Warn your patients. And with that in mind, we can basically move forward from there. So I think we're in good shape.
So maybe a basic or simple question, but, you know, I've been hearing about these agents, particularly from you, for a long time and really been surprised that it hasn't come into practice. They haven't been approved. Do you see this happening in the near future? And why did it take so long?
That's a great question, Neil. I think that in essence, I'm very hopeful that this year we will see a radical change in just what you said, that we'll see approval for both iberdomide and mezigdomide. I'm very much hoping so. I think in fairness, you know, we've, in the last 5-6 years, we've had the extraordinary challenges of the pandemic and all that that's meant. And in fairness, we've also had the extraordinary success of the bispecifics, CAR Ts and so forth. I think it's also very important in the myeloma space to understand that to get a drug approved nowadays requires a very concerted effort for comparisons. You know, in other words, you can't simply just say off a single arm trial, well, I've got a response rate of 30%. Surely that's good enough for accelerated approval. In the old days, that was reasonable because our therapeutic options were more limited. Nowadays, especially with the incredibly high efficacy of bispecifics and other approaches, this is more challenging. You have to have active controls. I think at the same time, and this is very important, and I think I want to especially acknowledge FDA because I think they've realized this too. There is a real world aspect to all of this. And I think, you know, when we had the sort of dizzying results coming from bispecifics and CAR Ts, there was a sort of feeling that unless you have a response rate of 70%, you might as well go home. Well, that obviously is clearly nonsense, right? Because at the end of the day, you know, there are so many of our patients who can't get those approaches and or those approaches have failed them. So a readily available community-based agent that can be given literally straight off the shelf and properly off the shelf, not sort of pretend, you know, you don't have to hospitalize anyone to get mezigdomide, for example. At the end of the day, if you can do that in the community and salvage patients in whom other prior approaches have failed them, that's a winning drug. And I think we've come to that now. And I think in that context, we're seeing mezigdomide really gather momentum. So I'm very hopeful that we'll see approval for mezigdomide this year. I'm also hopeful for iberdomide as well, recognizing that that can be a little bit more challenging because it's been tested in earlier relapse.
This concludes part one of the program. Special thanks to Dr. Richardson, and thank you for tuning in. Check out part two of this conversation and some fascinating details on the Phase 3 Determination 2 clinical trial Dr. Richardson's about to launch, utilizing ESA-IVD, esatuximab, bortezomib, iberdomide, and dexamethasone induction, and ESA-IVR maintenance, and a high-risk arm randomizing patients to either consolidation autologous transplant or the BCMA bispecific lenvoseltamab. This is Dr. Neil Love for Inside the Issue.